The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Nechemiah and Shimon HaTzadik, is the sixth of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Avram Yitzchak Ben Shlomo Olav Shalom, Mr. Alfred Ivor Stebbins of blessed memory.
Yes. Sir Winston Churchill, the former Prime Minister of England, in describing the role of the British Royal Air Force in defending against the attack of Germany in 1941, made the immortal quote, "Never in the history of human conflict have so many owed so much to so few." In reality, though, if one looks through the pages of the history of human conflict, as well as the history of the major political, social, and economic changes that have transpired throughout the ages, one sees that those changes were wrought by a relatively handful of people. Jewish history is no exception. The period that we're covering now, one of the most critical in Jewish history, the beginning of the Second Temple, was deeply impressed by the work of a relatively few. These are the people that we call the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, men of the Great Assembly. Last time, we spoke about the work of one of the major, most prominent members of that assembly, Ezra. I'd like to devote this lecture, basically, to two others of that period, members of the Great Assembly, Nechemiah and Shimon HaTzadik. In addition, if we have time during this lecture and the next lecture, we'll be reviewing at this juncture the differences between would be the secular chronological system, dating and history of the period, and the traditional, the Talmudic history of the period. I'd like just to take a few moments to review what we've covered during the period, and then continue on. The Babylonian Empire lasted for a period of 70 years. It began with the conquest of Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. In the second year after that conquest, next year, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael, Judea. Nebuchadnezzar's reign lasted for 45 years. His successor, his son, Evil-Merodach, according to the Seder Olam, the traditional source of our history, reign was for 23 years. Belshazzar, his son, in turn reigned for some 2 years. All told, the Babylonian Empire was 70 years. The Babylonians were conquered by a combined force of Persians and Medes. The leader of the Medes was Darius, Daryavish, the first Darius. The leader of the Persians was Koresh, or Cyrus. Darius reigned, this first Darius, for 1 year, After his death, Cyrus Keresh, the leader of the Persians, who was in fact related, according to tradition, is related to Darius, it was his son-in-law. Koresh reigned for 3 years. After Koresh came Ahasuerus, who reigned for 14 years. All told, then, we have so far, we have 18 years. The successor of Ahasuerus was Daryovish Darius the Persian, another Darius, a second Darius. In the second year of his reign, the beginning of the temple finally began to be built in earnest. Originally, in the first year of Cyrus, he gave permission for Jews to emigrate from Babylon to Israel. There were some 42,000 Jews that went, and they started building. They laid the foundation, but after a short time, the building was basically halted. Now, in the second year of Darius, it began anew. It took them 4 years to complete. In the sixth year of Darius, the temple was built. In the seventh year, as we explained last, according to the Seder Olam, according to the Talmudic interpretation, that Darius was one and the same king as Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes. In the seventh year, as it's recorded in the book of Ezra, of Artaxerxes, which was Darius, Ezra came up. As we explained last time, Ezra dealt not only with reinstituting the court system, by reinvigorating the commitment to learning Torah, to observe the Torah, he also was aware of an acute problem, that of intermarriage. Some 13 years after Ezra came up, we find another great personage having tremendous influence. This is Nehemiah. And the beginning, the story of Nehemiah, is, if you have your notes, it's on page 1. And we've titled the beginning of this first section, Nehemiah and Sanballat. As we're going to see, that Sanballat plays a major role, not only in the story of Nehemiah, but we're going to see in the story of Shimon HaTzadik, and also in terms of correlating the secular chronology with the traditional one. Nehemiah, as the book of Nehemiah starts, was a wine bearer to the king Artaxerxes, which according to tradition is Darius. And it begins, and let's read the first paragraph here. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Chachaliah, and it came to pass in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, this is of Artaxerxes, as I was in Shushan, the palace, this is the same Shushan that we know from the Purim story, that Hanani, and we're going to hear that name again, remember the name, one of my brethren came, he and certain men of Yehuda, and I asked them concerning the Jews that, the translation that you find here is what would be called the standard translation. Basically, we're dealing with the remnant who had left Babylon, left the Babylonian Empire, and had emigrated to Israel, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Yerushalayim. He was concerned with their welfare and about just the general welfare of the city. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left, the remnant of Yerushalayim is burnt with fire, and as the city is really in sad shape. And he was very much depressed, and the end of the first chapter of Nehemiah ends with a prayer that he asks Hashem to help the Jewish people. And the second chapter begins with him fulfilling his duties as the cupbearer of the king. And the king recognized that something was amiss. And the king asked him, "What's wrong with your face?" And said, and Nehemiah replied, says, why shouldn't I be sad? Says, when the city, the place of my father's grave, says, lay waste, and the gates are consumed with fire. His concern was, as we're going to see, was not just in terms of the aesthetics, but by the fact that the Jews were surrounded with a hostile populace. The fact is that they did not have a walled city, which was of extreme importance. Up until the Middle Ages, by the way, that the best defense was having a walled, a secured walled city. It was only with the advent of gunpowder and the perfection of cannons that it became, the whole idea of a walled city really became unnecessary, because as long as it is the whole idea of just sealing yourself in a city no longer was an option. In those days, though, this was the ultimate defense, and without it, they were entirely exposed to the enemy. And the king said unto me, and you should notice that the queen also sitting by him, "How long shall that journey be? When will you return?" And I set a time. It's interesting about the note that the queen was sitting by him, and it's not clear what the import of that statement is. The Malbim suggests an interesting theory that the queen that we're talking about is not the wife of the king, but actually the queen mother, referring to Esther. According to this, follows a tradition that Esther was the mother of the actual mother of Darius. It would also be good, even if he wouldn't be the actual mother, but have being a person that would have exerted a tremendous influence over him. When he finally came to Eretz Yisrael, and he came under armed guard, and he was appointed actually in that time as really the governor, and he was given royal powers, it created a tremendous problem with the powers that be at the time. The major power in that area were the Samaritans. And they exerted a tremendous influence on the Jewish populace. As you recall, they had originally made an attempt to work together with the Jews to build a temple. This is the first year of Cyrus when the Jews came. They were rebuffed. They tried as much as they could to prevent the building of the temple through using their influence. Ultimately, though, the Jews were successful in building the temple. But they still exerted tremendous pressure. The leader of the Samaritans was Sanballat. And we're going to hear about him throughout this lecture. And when Sanballat the Horonite, Tacharoni, and Tovia, the servant, as the Eved, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that and this is the words of Nehemiah, that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. This basically, they looked at the Jews as under their thumb. And now there was somebody here who was determined to create a quasi-independent Judea. And we turn the page in page 2. Page 2, this is in section, this is in paragraph B here, in the beginning of page 2. Refers that when Nehemiah came for settled there, he made a secret trip at night to see the state of disrepair that the walls were in. And he made a very careful study of it to make sure at that point that others weren't looking. When he was satisfied with what he had seen, next day he came and gathered the people together. And this is the quote, as you read. "And he finished, 'Let us build up the wall of Yerushalayim.' that we be no more reproach. In other words, to, we should know the Hebrew word is cherpa. And at least he made the initial step. In other words, he made a reconnaissance of the area. He began the plans. And then when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tovia the servant, and then we have a third player here, Geshem, who was an Arab, evidently an Arab leader in the area, heard it, they laughed at us to scorn and despised us. In other words, their first means trying to stop the Jews building was through psychological warfare. You'll never do it. It's like this. And they said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? In other words, they wanted to force the Jewish people to give up the idea, in the sense that we have close connections to the king, and if you start, we will use our influence to not only stop what you're doing, but you will pay for it as well. We'll consider you as rebels. That did not stop Nehemiah. And actually, he started building the wall. And once they got into the... they really got into this, the swing of things. And this is, we have now in paragraph C. And it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we built the wall, he was wroth. The building was actually beginning. And he says, it took great indignation and mocked the Jews. Again, the approach was through mockery. And as you say, he says, he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria, as he was speaking with the whole army already, and said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? In other words, will they, by bringing karbonas, by bringing sacrifices, will they somehow, will they get the help of Hashem to help them build? Will they make an end in a day? And they tried a very heavy, we call this a PR program, to force the Jews, in terms of their own meekness and in terms of the fear of retribution, to stop the building. And what they said was just an amazing thing as well. Even the stones are not fit, they said, to be used. Even if you will go and use these stones to build the wall, they'll be of no use, because we'll just push ourselves through the stones. And as we'll just take a battering ram, just a ram through these stones. Will they revive the stones out of the heap of the rubbish which are burned? As they were burned stones, they're already inferior. That didn't stop Nehemiah. And they continued building the wall. And as it explains, that they had, it was done in a very organized manner, and different sections of the city were allocated to different groups, so that each part, as they could work simultaneously, in an organized manner, in building the wall. When it was built already halfway, that Sanballat saw already that his first approach of psychological warfare was not successful. And he made plans to actually use his men and his army to attack the Jews while they were building. Nehemiah heard about the plans. In fact, he knew exactly where the Samaritans were planning to attack. And it says, as we see, after the bold type, he said, therefore, said I, in the lower places behind the wall and on the dry places, having set the people after their families, and this is where they were supposed to be building, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And as they actually were waiting for them to attack. And it came to pass, when our enemies heard that it was known to us, that they were actually afraid to start up with the Jews. So even though initially, they had, because of their because of intelligence gathering, they knew when the attack was supposed to be, and because of that, it was not even the anticipated attack really never came to be. They were still afraid of what would be commonly called snipers. They were afraid of would be other forms of harassment and attack. So as they were building, they had an armed guard with them. So you had the builders building, and you had guards to make sure. And there was a system of really of that everyone had a chauffeur, that if they would attack in one area, they would be able to call the men to arms in the adjacent areas to come to help. And it was because of this effort that the whole wall was built. And then we turn to page 3 in paragraph E. And now it came to pass, when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall, and there was no breach left therein. In other words, the whole wall, which had been breached in the attack of the Babylonians, had all been totally repaired with the exception of the doors on the gates. So actually, the doors were not up, but the wall, the stonework had already been in place. That Sanballat already saw there was just a matter of time putting up the doors, that he tried another tack. And that was that he would try an ambush. That Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, this is in the bold type here, in paragraph E, come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. And they thought to do to me mischief. In other words, that their men would be laying in waiting, and that would be the end of Nehemiah. And he goes on, Nehemiah, to describe the various means that they tried to lure him into this trap, but they were not successful. And in paragraph F we have, so the wall was finished in the 25th day of Elul, in 52 days. As if from beginning to end, it took them 52 days. And when the enemies heard about it, they were not very happy. Nehemiah goes on in describing this, to describe not only the physical problems of the time, but the spiritual problems of the time. At that time, because of the poverty, people who had taken out loans, and the loans were due, and their fields had been taken for pledges, they had, because of desperation, they had pledged their children to be indentured servants for these people. The social conditions were alarming. And Nehemiah took the initiative and persuaded all those that had loans outstanding to forgive the loans. All of the yeshiva would have this. And he became himself a model of fiscal responsibility, that he took no salary for himself for all the work that he did, even though those who had been previously appointed as governors, and it would seem to be these were not necessarily Jewish, had really misused the office. Another step that he took, something we discussed last time, that he brought Ezra, and then the gathering, this is the 25th of Elul, on Rosh Hashanah, a few days later, 5 days later, he brought them all together, all the Jews of Judea, and they read the Torah together. Later they celebrated Chag HaSukkos together. And at the end of the month, on the 24th of the month, they gathered them again together to make a commitment, to make a bris, to make a covenant to observe the Torah. We discussed part of that bris last time in terms of the prologue of that bris. This was the cry that they made, the prayer, which Chazal, the Gemara, interprets to be the end of the Yetzer Hara, of the inclination for idolatry. We are reading now from the actual covenant, and this is on page 4. And this is from the bold type. This is taken from the covenant. The first commitment they made is that we would not give our daughters unto the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. Basically, this is the assumption, of course, that these are people who would not make a full commitment to the Torah, the people of the land. We're not dealing with Gerit Tzedek, we're dealing with people, basically the husband and wife would lead different lifestyles, so to speak. And that was forbidden. The second thing, as we read, was about doing business on Shabbos. And if the people of the land bring ware, any food on Shabbos day to sell, we would not buy it of them on Shabbos. Or says on, it would seem on the holy, or basically on any yontif. The third, and this is rabbinical. The third is that we would leave the seventh year in the exaction of every debt. This is the Shemitah Sksofim. This is the every 7 years, basically all the debts are forgiven. That we will commit ourselves to follow that. The fourth was something which affects us to this day. This also, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. In addition to the chatzi shekel, the half of shekel which is mandated to be given yearly, because of the poverty of that community, from the commentaries it seems it did not suffice. And it was necessary for them to make an additional commitment, a third of a shekel. The Gemara in Bava Basra uses this as the idea of, in a time where there is no temple, though, but there are other compressing communal needs, at least a third of a shekel should be set aside for communal needs in terms of tzedakah for social needs. And as a bare minimum is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, that a third of a shekel is the bare minimum of giving that one is required. As even one can't afford miser, can't afford a tenth to give, to set a tithing, to set aside a tenth of the income, but at least this amount should be minimally given. And it goes on to describe all the things that are needed in the Beis Hamikdash. That are needed for those monies. The next, which is, let's see, the final area of this covenant, and as the covenant, of course, went to a commitment for the Torah in toto, plus extra emphasis for these areas, would seem to be an innovation of sorts. That the according to the Torah, there are certain entitlements that are given to the Kohanim, to the priests, to the Levim, to the Levites. These entitlements come from the grain. This is from the korbanos, from the sacrifices. When it comes in terms of the grain entitlements, we're dealing with people, the priests and the Levites do not have land. They don't have fields normally. They have no other source of income except that which is given to them by the community. The purpose of why the Torah chose these people is not only, as we normally understand, because of their service in the temple, but also, equally so, is l'man yechzeku b'toras Hashem, that they can spend the time to strengthen their study and their commitment to the Torah. The Kohanim and Levim were the teachers of the Jewish people. The support for these people is a support for scholarship. If they would have to go around from city to city, it would take away from their learning. It would take away from their spiritual growth. And therefore, Nehemiah instituted that there would be a central place that all the tithes, all the entitlements would be placed. So it would enable the Kohanim and the Levim to live near the temple complex in Yerushalayim and devote their life
to spiritual endeavors without having to go through the process of trying to make ends meet by going basically begging from place to place. This was the basic commitment that they made. After they made the commitment, Nehemiah wanted to make sure that there be that Yerushalayim that was now newly rebuilt and newly fortified would have a constant populace. And here they took that 1 out of 10 of the people, besides the individuals that on their own volunteered, 1 out of every 10 would be allotted a place in Yerushalayim. That would be his place for dwelling. And it's interesting, there's a comment made because those who did at least voluntarily accept to live in Yerushalayim got a special bracha, got a special blessing, because it is difficult to live in a city. Dearest Krochim Kosha, it's difficult to live in the cities. There's even though there may be advantage in terms of goods and services, but the cramped conditions and the pollution and the various issues and noise pollution is something that people are, at least in those who were hesitant to live in cities. Those who live in Detroit, of course, and don't live in New York appreciate this. It goes on. After the basic commitment had been done, and they were assured that there would be a populace in Yerushalayim, Nehemiah went on to dedicate the walls of Yerushalayim. And in this dedication ceremony that's in paragraph I here on page 5, Ezra, as you know, also took a prominent role. Nehemiah stayed from the year 20 of Artaxerxes to the year 32, as he was there as a governor for 12 years. And he could no longer stay there because of commitments that he had to the Persian court, and went back for a period of time. When he came back, and it's not clear how long this was it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? But he saw that much of the work that he had tried to implement became undone. The central room, the repository for the entitlements of Kohanim and Leviim, had fallen into disuse. That whole system was no longer there, and in fact, it was now made for a storage area for Tobiah, the Ammonite, Ammoni, who was within the arch enemy, the nemesis of Nehemiah. Also, that which he tried to discourage with the covenant of the selling of goods on Shabbos had also come to a halt, and people were coming in, non-Jews were coming in with their wares to sell goods on Shabbos. Because this is how the Malbim, this is how the commentaries explain, this is what Isaac Halevi explains, that because of the whole that Shabbos had lost its tam, so to speak, in Yerushalayim, and it became a day of commerce, Jews, not only non-Jews, were to a very small extent also involved in Chil Shabbos, because they started already shipping, as to bringing wares. And once they're starting to ship, they started doing actual malachas. They started actually doing work on Shabbos. And a third issue that he had addressed Nehemiah that had fallen to disuse was intermarriage. When he came back, of course, he describes the measures that he to reinstate all that he had originally began. One has to realize, understanding that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, I mean, some of them were still alive. Ezra, it seems, as we're going to explain, was still alive. And yet these things were happening. Evidently, there was tremendous political pressures placed that their ability to stop what was happening was very limited. And only Nehemiah, who came as the with the power of the Persian throne, was able to implement again to reinstate those changes. One of the major problems that he encountered was that those people, both this Tovia, who was also stated was not only was a person who wielded power, their political power, but was intermarried in some of the most prominent families. Sanballat also was intermarried. And as we see here on paragraph M, page 6, one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law to Sanballat. And here's a man who is married to the to the Samaritan, married to the daughter of the Samaritan. We're going to see more about this couple later on. Who is a major Kohen and playing a major role in the temple. And he chased him out. So Nehemiah saw to it that he would no longer have that role. This is basically how the book of Nehemiah ends, on this note. According to the traditional dating system, this is prior, perhaps a few years or perhaps even a few months prior to the Greek invasion. And it's interesting that now we go to section 2, Alexander and the Samaritans, that at this juncture of time, with the attack of Alexander, again we find Sanballat. And we have what would seem to be the narrative in Nehemiah told over in slightly different words by Josephus. And this is paragraph A of section 2 in Alexander and the Samaritans. Now, when this Jonas Yochanan had departed this life, Yochanan was the son of Eliashib. He was the son of Jehoiada. In other words, his son Yadua succeeded in the high priesthood. He had a brother whose name was Menashe. In other words, this Menashe was a son of Yochanan, a grandson of Jehoiada. And now there was one Sanballat, here we get the name again, who was sent by Darius, the last king of Persia, into Samaria. And he was a Kuthian by birth, of which stock were the Samaritans also. And as he stresses as well, the non-Jewish origin of the Samaritans. This man knew that the city of Jerusalem was a famous city. And this, again, this is Josephus's version of the facts. And this is the historian in his own words. Their kings had given a great deal of trouble to the Assyrians and the people of Syria. So he wanted to create a counterforce against the power in Jerusalem. So they willingly gave his daughter, and he names her, whose name was Nicaso, in marriage to Menashe, as thinking this alliance by marriage would be a pledge and secure the nation of the Jews should continue their goodwill to him. Basically, it was a political decision, as we know in would be relatively recent European history, that these marriages were done to cement alliances. But, as we now have in paragraph B here, but the elders of Jerusalem, being very uneasy that the brother of Yadua, the high priest, though married to a foreigner, should be a partner with him in the high priesthood. In other words, he wasn't the high priest himself, but evidently he had a very high position, quarreled with him. For they esteemed this man's marriage a step to such as would be desirous of transgressing about the marriage of strange wives, as they considered And there's been an ongoing, actually there was an ongoing argument over through the ages about the status of these Samaritans and were they actually truly Gerim or not. And this would be the beginning of a mutual society with foreigners. This is Josephus's rationale. This is Josephus speaking. The fact is that they were concerned. This is Josephus putting in his own reasoning. And he had the bold type, so they commanded Menashe to divorce his wife or not to approach the altar, because they felt she didn't have the status of a Jewish woman. At least this is how Josephus describes the story, which would support the opinion that they held that the Samaritans were actually not Jews. And the high priest is joining with the people in their indignation against his brother and driving him from the altar. Of course, as we see before, that according to, assuming these are all the same players, it was Nehemiah, according to the Sefer Nehemiah, who was the one who drove him out. Here in this version, it was a mass group joined by his brother. Menashe came to his father-in-law Sanballat and told him that he loved his daughter Nekaso, yet he was not willing to be deprived of his dignity on her account, which was the principal dignity in their nation, always continued in the same family. So Sanballat had a great idea. He says, you know, why should you be second fiddle to your brother? I'll make you a Beis Hamikdash. I'll make you a temple. And it will be built on Har Gerizim. This is Mount Gerizim, which was the area which was holy to the Samaritans. As you remember in a previous lecture, we had this on the slides. We showed really up until this day, today, they have their service on Mount Gerizim. They sacrifice every year a Paschal Lamb, a Korban Pesach, on Mount Gerizim. So he would build him a Beis HaMikdash, a temple. And therefore he stayed with Sanballat. Now, and he was going to, Sanballat was going to arrange through Darius and his, that the permission would be allowed for such a building. At this time, he shows a very interesting, you find in the bold type here on page 7, which is, would be an addendum to the story we know already in the book of Nehemiah. There was now a great disturbance amongst the people of Yerushalayim, because many of those priests and Levites were entangled in such matches. In other words, as Nehemiah is at the end, this is referring to the end of the Persian period. For they all revolted to Menashe. It was because of the pressure that was placed on them now. And Sanballat afforded them money and divided them land for tillage and habitations also. That there grew a major, would be an alternate priesthood in amongst the Samaritans on Har Gerizim. Sanballat was unable, because of the military and the political changes, he was unable to get that permission from Darius. But when he saw that fortune was on Alexander's side, this is, and we're reading now in paragraph C on page 7, but Sanballat thought that he had now gotten the proper opportunity to make his attempt, so he renounced Darius. Remember, the Jews, when Alexander came and were asked by Alexander to help them, to help him against the Persians, refused, because they said, we had sworn allegiance already to Darius. Alexander was not very pleased with this. But now the Samaritans, in contrast to the Jews who were living in Judea, he says, we'll go and help you. And taking with him 7,000 of his own subjects, he came to Alexander, and finding him beginning the siege of Tyre, he set them to deliver up to him these men who came out of places under his dominion, in other words, under Sanballat's dominion, and did gladly accept of him for his lord instead of Darius. So when Alexander had received him kindly and had accepted the offer, then Sanballat thereupon took courage and spoke to him about his present affair. He told him that he had a son-in-law. There are many others of his own nation now with him. There desires to have a temple in the same place subject to him. In other words, not in Judea, but rather in Samaria. And it would be for the king's advantage to have the strength of the Jews divided into two parts, lest when the nation is of one mind, united, upon any attempt for innovation, it prove troublesome to kings, as it formerly proved to the kings of Assyria. In other words, this was the standard party line. In other words, it's best to weaken the power of the Jews in Jerusalem. Whereupon Alexander gave Sanballat leave so to do, and as he gave him official permission to build a temple. Who used the utmost diligence and built a temple. Evidently, they used the siege of Tyre took 7 months. And this was just in the beginning. He came back and built himself a temple.
Evidently, he had, as with the Jews, it took 4 years. Evidently, he had the manpower and he had the monies, and made Manasseh the priest, and deemed it a great reward that his daughter's children should have that dignity. But when the 7 months of the siege of Tyre were over and the 2 months of the siege of Gaza, Sanballat died. And Sanballat died right before, as we're going to see, that Alexander would now place his eyes towards Jerusalem. Now Alexander, who had taken Gaza, made haste to go to Jerusalem. And Yedua the high priest, when he heard that, as this is the words of Josephus again, was in agony and under terror, is not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. In other words, again, says when Alexander began the siege of Tyre and wanted local help, the Jews refused. What happened when Alexander marched on Jerusalem? In that, the event is described both in Josephus and in the traditional sources. The earliest source that we have from traditional sources of the event is a work called Megillas Tinus. Megillas Tinus is a collection of days which are minor holidays. This day that Alexander came to Jerusalem, as we're going to see, was declared a minor holiday. And the details of that event were recorded, and they were written down, would be some 40 years before the destruction of the temple. Josephus wrote down his account some 10-20 years after the destruction of the temple. And this is the account that, as is recorded in the Megillas Tinus, and is brought down word for word in the Gemara in Yoma, in Samach Tes, in 69a. The 25th of Tevis is celebrated as Mount Gerizim Day, and is forbidden in eulogies. In other words, this is the holiday, and in those minor holidays, some are just forbidden to fast, but one is allowed to deliver a eulogy. And others are not only one is not allowed to fast during that day, but also one is not allowed to make a hespit and deliver a eulogy. At that time, the Samaritans asked permission from Alexander the Great to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Now, they wanted, not only had they built their own, but now they were really in for, they smelled blood. And he granted it to them. So really, the march towards Jerusalem was a march to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Now, Shimon HaTzadik was informed of their plans. As we're going to see, Josephus in his Antiquities, at this juncture of history, does not mention Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik, we know, in the second Mishnah of Pirkei Avos, he was Mishiyori Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the remnants of the men of the Great Assembly. He was a member of that Great Assembly. And as we're going to see, he is the central figure of this affair. Whereas, according to Josephus' account, Yadua, who is, a, by the way, mentioned in the book of Nehemiah, is the central figure. What did Shimon HaTzadik do? He put on the priestly raiments, the big de kahuna. The Gemara actually brings this to deal with the problem, is a Kohen allowed to wear his special clothes, or the raiments, outside of the Beis HaMikdash? And they want to bring this whole story, actually, this whole story is brought to prove a halachic point. And that's because he put on the clothes of the Kohen Gadol. The Gemara actually says that one can't, one cannot really prove that point from this story, since it was a question of life and death. We're going to see it was important that he make an impression on Alexander and the Greeks, and therefore he was allowed to, he was given a dispensation. And together with the most prestigious members of Yerushalayim, he walked by torchlight. In other words, he realized that in a short period of time, Alexander's army would be marching towards Yerushalayim. And actually, it was a forced march by night. So he came with his entourage to meet Alexander. All night, his group was walking from one direction, while the Greeks and Cruthian group, the Samaritan group, was walking from the other direction. At daybreak, when Alexander caught sight of the Jews, he asked the Cuthians, the Samaritans, who are these people? Because he didn't know Jews. I mean, he's walking there and he sees them coming, but he's still... They answer, the Jews who have rebelled against you. It's always good to hear a gutter Wort, you know. I mean, it's always a good word. By the time he reached Antipatris, the sun rose and the two groups met. As soon as he saw Shimon HaTzadik, Alexander went down from his chariot and bowed down to him. Josephus describes the same story, but the object of the bowing was the high priest Yadua rather than Shimon HaTzadik. Alexander's entourage asked him, a king of your stature should bow down to a Jew? He replied, the apparition of that man was shown to me before my victory on the battlefield. In other words, I saw that man before. Josephus brings the story slightly different. That before Alexander embarked on his campaign to conquer the civilized world, while he was still in Macedonia, he had a dream, and the picture of this high priest came to him and told him, go and conquer. So he had seen that face. He felt that image or that person embodied was the reason of his success. Alexander asked the Jews, why have you come to me? And they replied, how is it possible that pagans should entice you to demolish the temple in which we pray, that you and your kingdom shall not be destroyed? And that is, we really mean your best interests. And it is, why should these... Is there people who are telling you to destroy the very place which is the source of all your success? Who are these people? Alexander asked. And the Samaritans that stand before you. He said to them, behold, you have the authority to do them as you with them as you please. Immediately, evidently this is a... Basically, they killed them. But immediately they pierced their heels and tied them to the tails of their horses and dragged them over thorns and brambles until they reached Mount Gerizim. As soon as they reached Mount Gerizim, they plowed it under, and as they demolished the temple that had been built by Sanballat and planted with it, this is Karshinim, it was the horse beans, just as they had intended to do with the Beis HaMikdash. It's basically just to, as a sign that it is just totally destroyed. That day was declared a holiday. And it was the day that they went and destroyed Har Gerizim. As we have in paragraph E of page 8, he has it. I just quoted. I didn't quote the whole quote from Antiquities, but he has it. It's the high priest, which he had already said was Yadua. This is Josephus' version, that it was not Shimon HaTzadik, but rather
Yadua, who was in the high priest. The question of is there who is right over here? In other words, what is the how does one resolve the two accounts? Is really a question as a matter of speculation. I saw personally two very interesting what we call resolutions of the problem. One is the resolution of Rav Isaac HaLevi in his Sefer Doros HaRishonim. His theory is, Rav Isaac HaLevi's theory is, that although it's true, and Josephus had his facts correct, Yadua was the high priest, as it's recorded as the last high priest in the book of Nehemiah. It is also true, though, that it was Shimon HaTzadik and not Yadua who went. Josephus goes on to explain the yichus of Shimon HaTzadik, that Shimon HaTzadik became a high priest. He disagrees it wasn't a high priest then, but he eventually became a high priest, which would be indicative he was of that family. Shimon HaTzadik's father's name was Chonio, at least that's how it's brought, or at least we have from the Latin version of it, that Shimon's father was Chonio. Historians assume that this Chonio was the son of Yadua, and Shimon HaTzadik was in fact a grandson of Yadua. This is how historians assume to put everything together. Yadua, according to Rav Isaac HaLevi, he was an elderly person. It could very well be he no longer was serving in the capacity as the high priest doing the service because of perhaps infirmities of age. And his grandson, Shimon HaTzadik, who may have been an acting Kohen Gadol, even though a young man, after he was a man of great stature, being a member of the great assembly, went in his stead. So that, according to this theory, the Josephus had the fact right. Yes, it was under the auspices of the high priest, and Yadua was the official high priest then, but the version of the Megillas Tainis is also correct that it was in fact Shimon HaTzadik who came to greet them. This is Rav Isaac HaLevi's resolution of the problem, and subsequent historians have accepted that version. I saw a new explanation, an interesting explanation, proposed by Chaim Chafetz. We've mentioned his name before, and we'll mention it further on in terms of the discrepancy between the secular dating system and the traditional dating system. His theory is that Shimon HaTzadik is one and the same as Yadua. There's a tradition that Shimon HaTzadik, which is brought down in the early medieval historians, that the Sefer HaKabbalah, the Ravid, that in the Sefer HaYuchsin, that Shimon HaTzadik had an alternate name. Besides the name Shimon, he had the name Ido. At least that's their version. Dr. Chafetz conjectures, if possible then, perhaps maybe this Ido is really Yadua. Really, he had two names. And Shimon ben Chonio, the Chonio is really Yochanan, who is the father of Yadua. So it's really one and the same person. So really, they are both correct. Josephus's error, according to this theory, is that he considers Shimon HaTzadik a different person, and that's where the error was. But the facts he basically had were valid. He just putting the facts was the problem. So whereas Rav Isaac HaLevi's theory would have it that Josephus erred in some of the facts of the incident, according to Dr. Chafetz, he did not err in the facts themselves. Yadua was Shimon HaTzadik, is exactly the same person. The error was that in attributing later, speaking of Shimon HaTzadik, he deals him as a different person. Again, these are both just theories, and one is not sure. I would like now, in the last moments of the shir, to begin dealing with the problem of chronology, and this will be the subject also of the next lecture. If you have on page 9, as we see on page 9, section A, the Persian Empire existed for 34 years during the period of the Second Temple. That is, we call the traditional chronology. And this is the chronology of the Seder Olam, which was a work which came from the Mishnaic period. It is quoted in the Talmud. By the way, just as we're going, this is not just a minor quote, but as we see that all the discussions in the Talmud dealing with the period seem to point to the acceptance of this chronology. Just one example. Everything, at least the traditional dating system. Ezra came up, say, in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, of Artaxerxes. We know that the last prophets were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Haggai and Zechariah gave their prophecies in the early years of Daryavash. The last prophecy of Zechariah is in the fourth year of Daryavash or Darius. Malachi, it is not clear, at least from his words, there's no specific date within the work itself. But he does speak about two issues in the prophecy of Malachi, which would place him would be firmly in the era of Ezra and Nehemiah. One is a major theme that he deals with is intermarriage, as we see, which is a problem which Ezra dealt with Nehemiah dealt with, as we see from Josephus, being a problem at the end of the Persian period. Another theme that he deals with is supporting the Kohanim and the Levium and putting the tithes in a central repository, which is something which, as we see, was instituted by Nehemiah. Which would seem to say that Malachi lived during the period of Nehemiah Ezra. There's a discussion about the identification of Malachi. There's a major view in the Talmud that Ezra was Malachi. It also would be in consonant with the fact in Ovis to Rabbi Nosson, describing the chain of tradition from the prophets to the men of the great assembly, the last prophets were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. They transferred to the men of the great assembly. It seems they were the ones who gave the Torah to these people. From other sources, it seems Ezra was the leader of the great assembly. Of course, if Ezra and Malachi are the same person, everything works out well. And in many areas in the Talmud, we have quotes of traditions of halachic rulings of this group of three. And as the three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, were not just men who of high spiritual stature in the sense that they had these visions, but were the greatest authorities of Torah. And they are all mentioned in the same breath. When they died, prophecy came to an end. Inasmuch as we understand that the book of Nehemiah, Book of Ezra and Nehemiah, are part of canon, are part of Kisvei HaKodesh, And therefore it was written, the Ruach HaKodesh, it was written in divine inspiration, the book of Nehemiah, which also came to an end. It would seem that Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi lived at least as long as the book of Nehemiah was written, because it says when they died it all came to an end. After that death there were no more books that were considered Kisvei HaKodesh. The Bible had come to an end. In fact, as we quoted as we last lecture, in the vision when they captured this vision of capturing the evil inclination of idolatry, the one who pointed out this is he, this image of this lion of fire that came out of the Holy of Holies, the identification that this truly was the Yetzer Hora, the inclination of idolatry, was Zechariah. Because it was based on a previous prophecy that he had. He was alive then. The book, the Sefer Kuzari, places the end of prophecy, which is the end, the death of Haggai, with the advent of the Greek era. When the Persian era came to a close and the Greek era began, in fact, he puts it 6 years into the Greek era, which would be probably the death of Alexander. That is when those Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi died, and that's when the prophecy came to an end. It clearly places them at the end of the Persian era. That is the traditional dating system. As we're going to see, it is very difficult to deal with with all this information if one accepts, as we're going to see, the secular dating system. I would like to briefly just go through on page 9, before we actually deal with the chronological problem here. On page 9 and paragraph B, we find a prophecy of Daniel. Daniel describes a vision of four Persian kings. You read this. Behold, so there shall stand by ye three kings of Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. By his strength with riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Because he is the one, that fourth one is the one who will fight against the Greeks. Again, according to the traditional dating system, the three kings that we know of, says before, are Darius the Mede, Cyrus, Koresh, and Ahasuerus, the fourth being Darius the Persian. The book of Daniel, at least according as we see Josephus, was in the hands of the Jews by the time Alexander came. And in fact, when Alexander came to Jerusalem, he was shown the book of Daniel prophesizing his coming. So the book of Daniel, it seems, was a contemporaneous work, not a work that was written many years later than perhaps Greek, you know, the Persian history had been forgotten. It was written in that era. And it clearly speaks about just four kings. In paragraph D, we find here in Nehemiah, we have the Yichus, the genealogy of the Kohanim Gedolim. And these went through the period of Nehemiah. This is Yehoshua, this is the first Kohen Gadol, begat Yehoyakim, this is Yehoyakim begat Eliyashiv, Eliyashiv Yehoyada, Yehoyada Yoinison, or Yoichanan, he's called, he had two names, and Yoinison begat Yadua. Yehoshua was the son of Yehotzadok, the first Kohen Gadol, the first man on the list, who was a son of Saroya, who was the last Kohen Gadol. He was probably, being the last Kohen Gadol, he was the one who was taken. He was taken by Nebuchadnezzar. He was killed, in fact. we would assume as a probably, and one doesn't know for sure, but as a good chance, there was a man in his years. He was the high priest. You would assume he was a man, and at least one conjecture, a man in his 70s or whatever. He had a son already alive, Yehud Sadek, who was the firstborn. In terms of the system of marriage then, in Shemoneh Esrei L'Chuppah, one would assume that his son was some 20 or 25 years his junior. Yehoshua then would have been another 20, 25 years the junior, which would place him approximately between 20 and 30 at the time of the destruction of the temple. If that's the case, when they originally came back, in other words, at the time of the rebuilding of the temple, final rebuilding of the temple, that would make Yehoshua a rather old man. One doesn't know, this is a conjecture, but we're dealing with a man who's approximately 100 years old, 90, 100 years old. His son, in turn, if we put this as at that time, just placing what that time was, this is the building of the temple, his son would have been, let's say, he would be 70, 75. His son, in turn, would have been 50. I mean, again, this is just merely conjecture, of course, but just in terms of what would be just the standard. And if his son is 50, then that son would be 20, 25. And that son would just be a little, this Yonason would have been just a little boy, and Yadua wouldn't have been born yet. However, if we would assume that perhaps we tightened the years, and the Taka got married at 18, and they had children quickly, then that would place perhaps Yadua as already being born. Maybe he was an infant then. So this infant already saw his great-great-grandfather, Yehoshua. 20 years later, when Nehemiah came on the scene, this Yadua would be in his 20s. Eliyoshev would already be an old man. And when the Greek Empire came to an end, this is the 36th year of, it comes out in this Yadua, according to this assumption, this Yadua would be a man that would be approximately 36 or so. Assuming, according to this, a theory of Chaim Chafetz, that Shimon HaTzadik is Yadua, it could very well be then, here's the young man whose grandfather is still alive, and yet he was the young genius who was a member of the Great Assembly. He was still part of the family, and he was a younger member of that assembly. As we're going to see, otherwise there are other, this is all assuming the traditional the tradition. If we don't assume, we're going to encounter some problems. Another problem, paragraph E, is Ezra. There's a whole yichus of Ezra. And Ezra is the son of Seroya, who is the last high priest. There's a whole very detailed yichus all the way back to, I have the Achituv, it was very detailed. There's a skipping at this point of several generations, then it goes all the way back to Aaron HaKohen. The problem is, if we say Ezra is the son of Seroya, Seroya was the one who was killed, so that would put Ezra as a brother of Yehoshua. Maybe he was Yotzadik was the, he was a Pitzelkind, in other words, he was much smaller. Yotzadik was an elderly brother, perhaps. But it would clearly put Ezra then as an elderly person at the time in the Persian era, being the son of Seroya. And finally, on page 10 in section F, we find, this is in Daniel, this is the vision of the future history of the Jews, the 70 period of sevens, which is interpreted to be that this is the 490 years which lasted from the destruction of the first temple till the destruction of the second temple. And this whole period would be a period of Golus. In other words, that the Jews were condemned to suffer for 70 years in exile because they had one out of every 7 years they had not let the land lay fallow. But the other 6 years, in other words, during the period which they sinned in history, which they are now having to pay for, if as of one out of every seven they let the year, they worked the fields. And he says, well, throughout the Jewish history, in the time they came in, in the time of Joshua, in the time of destruction of the temple, they let 70 periods of Shemitahs go by, and that's why they're suffering. One assumes then that they weren't such great tzaddikim the other years either. And it's for those other years that they are doomed to have this partial golus, so to speak. So they have a temple, they're in the land, but they are under foreign domination. So it comes out then there are a total of 490 years that they have to have an accounting of the years that they had sinned in the past. 70s were the years that they were truly in exile, and they let the land, they did not till the land. And the other 420 correspond to the other years which they had not lived up to their spiritual potential. This is the assumption of the basic Jewish chronology. And again, we're going to go in greater detail next time. I just want to show here, though, as we're going to see this last page on section G, now we're going to compare the traditional chronology with what is the accepted secular chronology, and you see the great difficulty involved here. If you notice here, we'll start the destruction of the first temple. The accepted year secularly is 586 before the Common Era. The traditional year is 421 or so before the Common Era. If you go down to section 12, now Alexander the Great, or 13, there's number 13, conquest of Persia. The conquest of Persia, we have at 331 before the Common Era. But as we see that the even though there's a slight discrepancy here, but if you take from 331 to 586, that's from the destruction of the, we have not just merely what would be a little over 100 years, but some 250 years. And the reason being that in the interim, this interim period, we have these kings. You notice that there are kings listed here in the section G, which do not have what would seem to be a Jewish equivalent. Cyrus is accepted by both. We have years for both, even though there's a discrepancy in the years. Ahasuerus, as a king during the period between Darius and Cyrus, is unknown. We have another king by the name of Cambyses, who is a son of Cyrus. And then we have Darius, again, it comes together. And then we have a whole list of kings after this Darius that are unknown. You know, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, second Darius, a second and third Artaxerxes, a third Darius, until we come to Alexander. The problem of the resolution of these two histories has been an area of great concern to Jewish historians. The first one that I've seen to dealt with the problem is the Abarbanel. And he, out of hand, just dismissed the non-Jewish history as inaccurate. The first one we have recorded who dealt with it and who accepted the secular chronology, and of course, Delt had an alternate interpretation, not the traditional interpretation, into the biblical works, was the author of the Sefer called Maor Einayim. This sefer, this Menachem, says the Huadoimi, he was called. He lived in Italy. He was a rav in Italy, who accepted the non-Jewish chronology, and as a result had a different interpretation of the biblical text, which again a totally different approach than we call the traditional approach to do it with the history. It's told over that the Beis Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, before he died, for this and for other reasons, wanted to put the sefer into excommunication. They have the sefer burned. I saw it in the Lakewood Library in Yeshiva. The Maharal really wrote a whole sefer dealing with this and other critiques of the Moray Nayim, and in dealing with the problem with the chronology, says that again takes the stance that the non-Jewish chronology is totally unreliable. There was a Dayan in Frankfurt in the 17th century who the famous Shaloh, the Yeshaya Horowitz, the author of the Shnei Luchos HaBris, who was the Rav of the city then, he wrote a sefer, this Dayan, called, the Oymitz Yosef, who's the Yosef Han, who writes in the preface of his work dealing with the problem, maintains it was a Christian plot. The reason being as follows, in other words, again, which is not really that we know that the source is really from pagan sources, not from Christian sources, but the reasoning is a fascinating one. We know from the Gemara in Avodah Zorah and Daf Tes that the world is supposed to exist for 6,000 years, at least there's an ancient tradition. The first 2,000 years are Yemei Toyu, the non-formed, chaotic years. The next 2,000 years are the years of Torah. The last 2,000 years are Yemos HaMashiach, where he is destined to come. Because of the chronology that they have, I don't know if you're familiar with the Scopes trial. The year that was used in the Scopes trial was the year 4004 before the Common Era, which according to Father Usher was the time of creation. We have a different year. Ours is 3761 before the Common Era. Now, assuming, again, he had the calendar, the Christian calendar that we have begins with the year 1 on the assumed birth of the founder of Christianity. This was one of the Christian scholars in the 6th century of the Common Era came up with that year. In reality, since Herod, who according to the story in Luke and Matthew, wanted to kill Yeshu, and Herod died 4 years before the Common Era, so it must have been his birth was then at least 4 years before the Common Era, the founder of Christianity, because he was born when Herod was still alive. So they realize there's an error, and that's why Father Usher put the creation year 4004 before the Common Era, which would mean to say then 4,000 years had already transpired before his birth, meaning that you already have the first 2,000 years of Shnas Toyu, of the chaotic years, 2,000 years of Torah, now this is Yemos HaMashiach. That's why in terms of the millennium, I think of the next, that again, the Yemos HaMashiach will come to an end, and now the second coming will come. This is the basis of this. And he maintained, the Yosef Han, that this was really a plot to change the calendar to work out the years. The years should work out well in order to fit in with Christian theology. But that really doesn't seem to be the case. The first one that I saw to really deal with this issue, though, in light of what would seem that all the compelling sources that would seem to indicate that that the traditional version is the correct one is this Dr. Chaim Chafetz. His approach, which we will discuss at length next time, is based on the approach of Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky, not in terms of the years, Velikovsky assumed the secular dating system, but in terms of going to the very root, the heart of what the secular system is based on. So what are the documents that the secular, that our history is based on? They're taking what were their documents and how do they fit, how do they create a history? And what he shows, and we'll discuss this at greater length next time, is that there was no continuous Persian history as we have like a continual Jewish history, that the years are constantly written up. We don't have the original Persian documents. And even after we've deciphered the cuneiform, very little was left of the original Persian Empire that we could even decipher and thus define much of what was left of them. Our history is based on the Greeks. And they, in essence, made a reconstruction. They reconstructed this system based on the documents that they had from various observers. This is Dr. Chafetz's contention, that if one took those same documents, one could fit them in equally well or as better into the system that we know as a Jewish system. So this is something we're going to discuss next time. I just want to leave you, though, as we said, Sanballat, who plays such a crucial role in the story of Nehemiah and the story of Alexander the Great, also plays a role in understanding the question of secular chronology versus the traditional chronology. If we want look at this this chart, and we put Artaxerxes the first, right? If we look at this, and we place him probably in the year 465 to 424, right? Then the 20th year of Artaxerxes, which would naturally follow, would seem if we accepted this chronology, and at the same time took the books of the Bible, took Nehemiah, and we would assume that Artaxerxes then is this man, would say that Nehemiah came in the year 445 before the Common Era. And his nemesis is Sanballat. Josephus records that would be in the time of Alexander or the last Darius, if we would impose the secular system, that Sanballat is the head of the Samaritans. He really had a Riches Yomim, this man, and this really lived a long time. Is it really the same man? Could he have been there and been by in the year 445 before the Common Era? At the same time, in the year 331 before the Common Era? What complicates matter further is that in the year 1906, they discovered on the island of Elephantine, which is near Aswan, is before the dam was made, an old building which they found a treasure of old papyri. That was written in the time of the Persian occupation of Egypt. And in it, it describes, in the 17th year of Darius, the sons of Sanballat, and speaking of Sanballat as the governor of the governor of the Samaritans. Well, that works out very well in our system. If we don't accept it, then the Darius, if he's in the secular system, then he can't be the same man as Nehemiah is in this. So we put him in number 7, Darius the Second, which would then place him that Sanballat already at that time, and Darius the Second, right, was 10 years after that, which was really then in the year 407 before the Common Era. Sanballat is still alive. Again, he has Arichas Yomim, but I mean, it becomes very difficult. I mean, he would be a rather old man, because if he had such power then at the time of Nehemiah, evidently he must have been in years. What was found later, they found another document which put Sanballat in the year right before Alexander the Great. Another document was discovered. Are there three Sanballats? Or there's one? According to a traditional system, of course, it all fits in. According to the other system, it's not impossible, but becomes more difficult. Okay, are there any questions? Yes. The Josephus we have is written in Latin. It's only a mere speculation if he ever wrote in any other language but Latin. And in fact, we don't. We only have it today because it was eventually translated from the Latin. The Church preserved Josephus. It was not a Jewish document. Now there is, according to tradition, there is no two Dariuses beyond this. There is only one. Now, this is the same Darius who built the temple and the Jews had pledged allegiance to, basically. That was through this whole period. This is really only one. There is a conjecture in fitting in just another, trying to put in Josephus with tradition to add another one. But the other is Josephus accepted totally the Greek system of chronology of the Persian and tried again to fit in Jewish history into the Greek framework. It's for that reason, it's interesting, he does not mention Sanballat in Nehemiah's time, because it's too embarrassing. See, he skips it totally and pushes him into Alexander's time.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.